Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen. Melody is in the office taking care of other client business. For all your physical gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some news, opinions, and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Tuesday, January 23rd, 2024. Hey, happy National Handwriting Day. Yes, January 23rd encouraged us to put pen to paper and write out our thoughts. According to the Writing Instrument Manufacturers Association, today's a chance for us to re-explore the purity and power of handwriting and probably buy a couple of pens and pencils to boot. Me? No, thanks. Granted, I used to have sterling handwriting. Well, in elementary school anyway. It may have seemed awkward, if not backwards, to my teachers since I am left-handed. But years later, I've evolved almost exclusively into a typist or keyboardist for you latter-day techies. That's been a double-edged sword, too. But having what I like to call digital arthritis, holding a pen, especially for an extended letter, is no longer any fun or practical. And oh, if Mrs. Tompkins, my fifth-grade teacher, could see my garbled signature today, she'd have a fit. On the other hand, it does make for a conversational autograph. Let's get to today's market report. First, the precious metals. Gold, let's see, up $7 and change at $2,029 in the New York spot aftermarket as we speak. Silver, a big jump today at about 1.6%, 35 cents to $22.51. Platinum up about a percent, $8, $910. And palladium up a little over a percent, 10 bucks at $972. Now, that all comes on the back, actually, of a slightly increased U.S. dollar index, up about a quarter of a point to 103.58. In other commodities, oil, domestic, West Texas Intermediate, 70. I'm sorry, that's actually down about 24 cents at $74.52 a barrel. that was above 75 briefly after UK and US strikes against the Houthis in Yemen. Talk about that in a minute. International Brent crude briefly hit 80 bucks before it came back down a little bit. Natural gas up about, what is that? Well, up 2.6% to $2.48 a cubic foot. In the Treasury market, most yields slightly up today. not all. The three-month was ever so slightly down, but the bellwether 10-year yield up 0.04 points to 4.14, we'll call it, percent. Two-year yield still showing a narrowing inversion, up ever so slightly, 0.005 points to yield 4.38%. And in the equity markets, mixed across the world today. Japan down ever so slightly. Hong Kong up almost 3%. Shanghai up 0.5%. Europe mostly down. Here in the States, the Dow Jones down 96 points, about a quarter of a percent. Close at 37,905. The NASDAQ up 66 points, roughly, 15,426. And the S&P 500 up 14 points, close at just about 4,865. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Like the winter coughing fits have returned. My my sincerest apologies. Hey, as I mentioned, oil held modest gains and then fell a little bit the rest of the day after the U.S. and U.K. made a fresh round of airstrikes against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. Global benchmark Brent crude was steady, just shy of 80 bucks a barrel at East Coast lunchtime today after rallying almost 2% on Monday. Now, fears of escalation are growing as the Houthis have vowed to continue attacking vessels until Israel pulls out of Gaza. And according to their prime minister, that ain't happening anytime soon. This comes after Israel said 24 of its soldiers were killed in Gaza yesterday, marking the worst single-day death toll for the Israeli Defense Forces since the war against Hamas began in early October. Companies around the world, from retailers to car makers, are also starting to weigh up the impact on profits of a long-term disruption to global shipping. Last night's strikes marked the eighth round of Allied attacks on the Houthis since the first one on January 12th. American and British forces said they hit eight targets, including an underground storage site and locations for launching missiles and carrying out air surveillance. The strikes were supported by Australia, Bahrain, Canada, and the Netherlands. They're the most significant, according to the U.S., since the original ones earlier this month. Residents in Yemen reported huge blasts at about midnight local time around Sana'a, the capital, and other areas. The Houthis have caused chaos for shippers by disrupting traffic through the southern Red Sea, a waterway that, well, previous to the attacks, accounted for 12% of global seaborne trade. The cost of shipping containers between Asia and the Mediterranean has more than tripled since early December, and that can usually mean only one thing, eventual rising prices. In other news, Boeing Corporation's travails continue as one of the plane maker's biggest customers says it's lost confidence in Boeing's ability to overcome the ongoing quality control lapses that, well, climaxed this month with a mid-air emergency on an Alaskan Airlines flight. United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby has been venting his frustrations with his management and Boeing's, voicing his concerns over the handling of the MAX grounding. He's also spoken to U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg over the grounding, which is now heading into its third week. The frustrations at United, which has been forced to ground dozens of 737 MAX 9 aircraft following the January 5th Alaskan Air accident, underscore the pressure on Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun and the company's board of directors. The Federal Aviation Administration, which grounded most of the MAX 9 fleet and is investigating Boeing production, doubled down on its scrutiny of the company over the weekend. The FAA's emergency order, which it said will affect about 171 planes worldwide, is the latest blow to Boeing over the MAX lineup of jets, which were involved in two deadly crashes shortly after their debut. The most recent one, a fuselage panel, blew out on an Alaska Air Boeing 737 MAX 9 7 minutes after taking off from Portland, Oregon. The rapid loss of cabin pressure actually pulled the clothes off a child and caused oxygen masks to drop from the ceiling. Miraculously, though, none of the 171 passengers and six crew members were injured. Pilots made a safe emergency landing. Now, hours after the terrifying incident, Alaska Airlines announced it would ground its entire fleet of 65 MAX 9s for inspections and maintenance. CEO Ben Minicucci, said Alaska expects the inspections to be completed in the next few days. On Saturday, Alaska said that the affected areas on 18 of its MAX 9s were inspected during recent intense maintenance work and were cleared to return to carrying passengers. But even the short grounding disrupted the airline. The MAX 9 accounts for more than a quarter of Alaska's fleet. On Saturday, Alaska canceled more than 100 flights, or 15% of its schedule, by late morning on the West Coast. United said it had canceled 33 of its 79 MAX 9s. Pulling the planes from service had caused it about 60 canceled flights. Analysts say the extent of the damage to Boeing's brand, well, will depend on what investigators determine caused the latest blowout. The MAX 8 and 9 differ mainly in size and are the newest versions of Boeing's venerable, or previously venerable, 737, that single-aisle plane frequently used on U.S. domestic flights. More than a decade ago, Boeing actually considered designing and building an entirely new plane to replace the 737, but afraid of losing sales to its European rival Airbus, which was marketing a more fuel-efficient version of its similarly sized A320, Boeing decided to take the shorter path of tweaking the 737. Thus, the MAX was born. The Bank of Japan, BOJ, kept investors guessing over when it will shift policy after sticking with its negative interest rate for now, while indicating it's getting more confident about hitting its long-sought inflation goal. Japanese Central Bank maintained its negative 0.1% short-term rate and kept its yield curve control parameters intact at the end of its latest two-day meeting. Now, with the hold, the BOJ retains its status as global outlier on policy, Well, along largely with the Central Bank of Turkey, as the Federal Reserve and European Central Bank hit at rate cuts beginning later this year. The yen strengthened against the dollar as investors looked for signs of when the BOJ will exit from its ultra-loose monetary policy. BOJ's governor, Kazuo Ueda, said certainty in the outlook is rising gradually. The bank cut its inflation forecast for the current fiscal year from April to 2.4% from 2.8% in a quarterly outlook report. That implies price gains will continue to exceed the 2% target for some time, as has been the case since April 2022. Major earthquake on New Year's Day and a deepening funding scandal engulfing Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's ruling party made this an inopportune time for Japan's first rate hike since 2007. 17 years. With the hold, the BOJ retains, as I said, its status as a global outlier. Manufacturing activity in the Fed's 5th District remains sluggish in January. That's according to the most recent survey from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Their composite manufacturing index fell to negative 15 this month from negative 11 in December, marking its third consecutive negative reading. This month's reading was more than twice as worse than the forecast of negative 7. Of its three component indexes, shipments actually edged up a little from negative 17 to negative 15, while new orders edged down from negative 14 to negative 16, and employment fell notably from negative 1 to negative 15. The Richmond Manufacturing Index is a gauge of manufacturing activity in the Maryland, North Carolina, District of Columbia, Virginia, most of West Virginia, and South Carolina regions compiled from a survey of give or take 100 manufacturers. The composite manufacturing index is an average of indexes on shipments, new orders, order backlogs, capacity utilization, supplier lead times, number of employees, and a few other areas. It's known as a diffusion index, meaning negative readings indicate contraction and worsening conditions, while positive ones indicate expansion and improving conditions. The survey offers clues to the Fed and others on inflationary pressures and the pace of growth in the manufacturing sector for this region of the country, and the accumulated results can help trace long-term trends. Well, today Turkey legislators began debating a long-delayed bill to approve Sweden's bid to join NATO in a step that could remove a major hurdle for the previously non-aligned country's entry into the broad military alliance. Turkey, who is a NATO member, has been dragging its feet on ratifying Sweden's membership for more than a year, accusing the country of being too lenient toward groups it regards as security threats. Turkey's been seeking concessions from Sweden, including a tougher stance toward Kurdish militants and members of a network that it blames for a failed coup in 2016. Turkey's also been angered by a series of demonstrations by supporters of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party in Sweden, as well as Quran-burning protests that literally roiled Muslim countries. Last month, Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee gave its consent to Sweden's bid in the first stage of the process after Turkey's President Recep Erdogan sent its accession protocol to lawmakers for approval. Swedish has pledged deeper cooperation with Turkey on counterterrorism and to support Turkey's ambition to revive its EU membership bid. Erdogan has linked ratification of Sweden's NATO membership to the U.S. Congress's approval of Turkey's request to purchase 40 new F-16 fighter jets and kits to modernize Turkey's existing fleet. He also urged Canada and other NATO allies to lift arm embargoes on it. Hey, I hear the music. Can it be? It is. Time for a short break. I'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's in the office today taking care of client orders. Call her toll free at 1-800-375-4188. Or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Well, with high mortgage rates and home prices, even though mortgage rates have been dropping the last few months, would-be homebuyers have been understandably looking for deals, even if they have to move to a different city or state, or region to find them. Last year, consumers moving to another state tended to pick new metropolitan areas where housing costs and competitions are less severe and construction is actually keeping up with demand. According to a recent Zillow analysis of United Van Lines data, homes in those consumers' new metros cost about $7,500 less on average compared to the places they left. Housing affordability has always mattered, and you're seeing it across the country. So says economist Orfi, I'm not sure how to pronounce this word, Devungi, at Zillow, who added, housing affordability is reshaping migration trends. The search for affordability has led a strong migration flow into states like Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, according to economist Jessica Louts at the National Association of Realtors. The cities in the Zillow analysis showing the most inbound moves included Charlotte, North Carolina, Providence, Rhode Island, Indianapolis, Indiana, Orlando, Florida, and Raleigh. North Carolina. The real estate market, as we've been talking about, is facing a low supply of active listings. While builders are trying to fill their gap with newer homes, they can only do so in areas where really it's financially feasible for both them and buyers. That's why Dvugny said you're seeing these relatively more affordable southern Midwestern markets rise to the top of the list. The draw of these metros, he maintains, is because they are markets where jobs are being created rapidly and where new houses are being built. For example, Charlotte and Raleigh both have become tech and financial hubs, attracting workers from metro areas as far away as New York City. And because of that, they've maintained relatively more affordable than other markets across the country. Excuse me. In the rental market, the cost to sign a new lease on a house or apartment is rising, but at a much slower rate than it was in the recent past, and may even be close to falling. But government inflation data show the opposite. Therein lies a key mystery for the economy in 2024. Economists say if rents finally start to provide some relief to overall inflation numbers, it'll give some confidence to policymakers on the Fed, who want to ensure that this period of high inflation is truly over before pivoting to lower interest rates. The disconnect between market rents and official inflation numbers is due to quirks in how the government calculates rent inflation. The narratives, however, have diverged for far longer than economists expected. Nicole Bashaud, who's a Zillow economist, said annual rent growth has stabilized over the last few months at slightly lower than pre-pandemic norms. Zillow's rent index actually fell 0.2% in December and was up just 3.3% over the last year. But the December CPI shows shelter still a prominent source of persistent inflation, responsible for more than half of the monthly increase. Rents for primary residents, in fact, were up 0.4% in December alone, and are up 6.5% over the last year. That's according to the latest CPI report. The failed Bank of America economists Stephen Juneau and Michael Gapin wrote recently in a note, despite significant moderation in asking rent inflation, CPI rents continue to run above pre-pandemic levels. The economists say this is due to CPI rents still playing catch-up to the level of asking rents. They say it could also reflect regional dynamics, as rents in the Northeast have proven firmer. The unusually rapid rise in rents during the pandemic means the gap between the private and the government data is larger than usual. Government uses a sample of rental prices, some of which are under fixed agreements that may not change for at least a year. Economists still say the catch-up is close at hand. We shall see. Overseas, in news that's potentially relevant to the States, a French regulator announced today it had fined the manager of Amazon's large warehouses in France 32 million euros. That's about $35 million for excessive monitoring of its employees. The French Data Protection Authority, known as the CNIL, said Amazon France Logistique gave employees scanners in order to record workplace tasks such as removing items from shelves and packing. This data was then used to calculate the quality, productivity, and periods of inactivity of each employee. Oh, lovely. CNIL ruled it was illegal to set up a system measuring work interruptions with such accuracy, potentially requiring employees to justify every break or interruption. The system for monitoring employee activity was described as excessively intrusive. That includes the company's policy of keeping data and statistical indicators on employees for 31 days. This is also described as excessive, even in light of the high performance targets at the business. CNIL said Amazon France Logistique committed several breaches of the EU's General Protection Data Protection Regulation, specifically around data minimization and lawful processing. Amazon said, "We strongly disagree with the CNIL's conclusions, which are factually incorrect." And of course, they reserved the right to file an appeal. The company added, "Warehouse management systems are industry standard and are necessary for ensuring the safety, quality, and efficiency of operations and to track the storage of inventory and processing of packages on time and in line with customer expectations." Hey, two new papers out last week shedding light on one of the big questions of the remote work era. After the pandemic, topic Melody and I have been talking about off and on for the past year. Does working from home make you more or less productive? Nearly 4 years into the start of the country's remote experiment, we're starting to get some answers. Now, we know increasing productivity is generally good for the economy and certainly for businesses. The first of these papers, a report from the San Francisco Fed, looked at 43 industries in the private sector to see if more remote-friendly occupations saw increased productivity during the pandemic period. Now, they didn't find any meaningful effect. Another report, though, a working paper from economists at the New York Fed, University of Virginia, and Harvard, looks at just one unnamed Fortune 500 company and found more nuanced answers. Pandemic, software engineers at this company either worked all together in one building, that is one team close together, or were more dispersed across buildings, a system that more closely mimics that work-from-home environment. Researchers looked at the differences between teams before and after the pandemic. Working close together, it seems, boosts mentorship, but may actually decrease productivity in the short term. Those working close to each other before the pandemic received more feedback on their coding. Sitting near teammates meant more senior colleagues gave more feedback to their juniors. Now, once everyone went remote at the height of the pandemic in 2020, the mentorship gap between workers in the two arrangements really disappeared. Meanwhile, engineers who worked closer together before the pandemic wrote fewer software programs than those who were more dispersed. The decline in productivity was the most pronounced for senior coders, who were presumably busier mentoring their younger colleagues. Now, after all the employees moved to remote work, junior workers who've been on the close together team were more likely to get a raise, perhaps benefiting from that early on mentorship. During the pandemic period, the close together workers had higher quit rates. The better training allowed them to score better paying jobs, the researchers at least theorized. One's proximity wasn't possible in an all remote setting. This company began hiring workers with more training, buying talent, that is, instead of building it. Now, that suggests, the authors say, that in the long run, businesses adapt to the way work is performed and could help explain why remote work didn't significantly change productivity rates in the first paper. At the highest level, the Labor Department measures productivity by looking at how much gets created divided by hours worked. But once you start zooming in from there, things get tricky pretty quickly, especially in the realm of knowledge work, where work from home is most prevalent and typically workers aren't producing easily measurable outputs. Thus, in my own mind, the jury appears to still be out. If you're a regular Financial Survival listener, you would have gotten the sense that an early 2024 interest rate cut was almost a sure thing. Now, just a few weeks into the new year, it's looking more like a coin flip. When the Fed's easing cycle begins, whether it turns out to be March or later this year, it will be a meaningful signal that a period of aggressive monetary tightening has ended, and Fed officials are comfortable that inflation is heading for its 2% target and with a low risk of flaring up again. Indeed, it's precisely because they seek that confidence that officials have probably played down market expectations that cheaper money is imminent. Well, this morning, futures markets priced in 60% odds that the Fed's target interest rate will be unchanged after its meeting that concludes March 20th, with a 40% chance of one or more rate cuts by then. Now, as recently as January 12th, that's 11 days ago, markets put 81% odds on a rate cut by March. They were 90% on December 27th. That quick shift is also reflected in an uptick in the policy-sensitive rate on two-year Treasury bonds, which were yielding 4.41% this morning, up from 4.14% on the 12th. As Melody and I have been discussing, this shift reflects a mix of strong data on growth, plus subtle messaging from the Fed. Fed leaders appear open to rate cuts in the not-too-distant future, but are making clear they need to see more decisive evidence that recent good news on inflation isn't yet another head fake. They need to see softer inflation in January, which will be evident in data released throughout next month, to feel comfortable, probably, cutting rates as early as March. Last week, Fed Governor Chris Waller said in mid-February, we will get the January CPI report and revisions for 2023, potentially changing the picture on inflation. My hope, he added, is that the revisions confirm the progress we've seen, but good policy is based on data and not hope. March rate cut could also be helped if GDP growth numbers started showing any real weakness. December retail sales up 0.6%, did just the opposite. Tim Dye, the chief economist for SGH Macro Advisor, says to get over the edge to a March rate cut, the Fed will need to see recent strength in the real data turn around. And given the timing of that data flow, in practice, this means that will need to happen with more evident weakness in the next two monthly employment reports. Oh, this next story gets my agita going. Surprise, surprise, ladies and gentlemen, the Fed's official watchdog cleared two former officials of any legal wrongdoing in a financing trading scandal that literally engulfed the Fed in 2021. At least the Fed's inspector general, whose office conducted the supposed independent investigation, slapped the hands of the ex-leaders, noting that their trading practices undermined the public confidence in the Fed. The conclusion of the two-year probe brings to a close one of the Fed's biggest ethical scandals in recent memory. Robert Kaplan, the former Dallas Fed president, and ex-Boston Fed pres Eric Rosengren resigned after financial disclosure showed they owned, and in one instance at least, actively traded assets in 2020, just as the Fed took extraordinary measures to blunt the impact of the pandemic. Inspector General concluded that the actions created, quote, an appearance of acting on confidential information, unquote, and quote, appearance of a conflict of interest, unquote, that might result in a reasonable person to question the official's impartiality. But they said the action didn't rise to the level of a violation of laws, rules, regulations, or policies related to trading activities as investigated by that office. Aside from the resignations, the scandal's biggest consequences came from the Fed itself, which massively overhauled longtime trading rules that proved inadequate. Well, I hear that music. It must mean we're in for another break. Stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. For all your physical gold and silver needs, call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Well, the 2024 presidential primary elections turned to New Hampshire today, where Nikki Haley is throwing harder punches, hosting more events, and appearing alongside the wildly popular Republican Governor Chris Sununu. But with the year's first Republican presidential primary well underway, Haley has fallen behind on one crucial metric, the one that counts the most, voter enthusiasm. At a Get Out the Vote event in Franklin yesterday morning at a small VFW hall, Haley said every single thing that Donald Trump has said or put on TV has been a lie. The close-packed crowd of between 100 and 200 people listened intently and nodded at the right moments. They offered few of the boisterous cheers and extended applause that's come to define Trump's carnival-like live events. On the contrary, several of Haley's applause lines were literally met with dead silence. Oops. That may have stemmed from the fact that it was early in the morning on a frigid, cold Monday in a state that's literally saturated every 4 years with reporters and TV cameras following politicians making this promise or the next. But it could also have been because not everyone in the crowd was actually planning to vote for Haley. Well, as the former South Carolina governor races to make up for Trump's fairly substantial lead, in the polls anyway, close to 20% on Friday, experts said higher than expected turnout today will be crucial. The problem for Haley is that enthusiasm drives turnout. And as Haley's morning in Franklin illustrated, attendance isn't the same as enthusiasm. The capacity crowd did include a few vocal Haley supporters, but the former UN ambassador is running out of time to keep pace with Trump, who just hours before had packed a 700-seat opera house in Rochester. Thornton, New Hampshire resident Pete Johnson said after the VFW event, "I'm confident she'll do well enough to continue." He added that he was not voting against Trump, but 100% for Haley. A lot of other people, particularly elderly people, who I saw interviewed on TV today, were just the opposite, saying their vote for Haley was more of a vote against Trump. Whatever the case, at the Sunday night Trump event, hundreds of people who had waited in line for hours in 19-degree weather could get inside because the event was over capacity. Dozens of these people stuck around by the entrance in the cold, even after being denied entry. Outside the venue, the long line of Trump supporters were distracted from the bitter cold by a pop-up marketplace that typically accompanies his rallies. Meanwhile, trucks carrying large screens and speakers periodically drove by, blaring a video made by the anti-Trump nonprofit Lincoln Project that describes the former president as a dictator. The truck drew profane jeers and hand gestures from those standing in line. Again, polls show Trump holding a wide lead, especially among registered Republicans. Still, Haley's running a far more competitive race in the Granite State than she did in Iowa, thanks in large part to New Hampshire's high proportion of undeclared voters who can vote in the primary. Haley came in third in Iowa, stunting her momentum and muddying her message that the primary was basically a two-person race between her and Trump. In recent days, Trump has also won endorsements from several of Haley's home state lawmakers, like South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott, Representative Nancy Mace, who represents Haley, ironically, in Congress, and, of course, Senator Lindsey Graham. Despite the setbacks and long odds, Haley's formidable force of will was on full display yesterday morning as she vowed to stay in the race regardless of today's outcome. Well, for now, the plot thickens, at least until later tonight. Well, the national mood seems to be taking a bullish turn. On Friday, stocks closed at a record high, confirming that investors are indeed riding a fully-fledged bull market. Separately, the University of Michigan's closely watched gauge of consumer sentiment posted a second straight monster monthly improvement. Now, it may just be a fluke, but some observers are saying the double dose of upbeat news could mark a turning point for post-pandemic America, where gauges of consumer satisfaction have been surprisingly sour, even in the face of a resilient economy, at least as measured by low headline unemployment and GDP growth. Some say the shift in mood could potentially reinvigorate President Biden's sagging poll numbers ahead of what promises to be a bumpy ride to the presidential election this fall. And now Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will travel to the Midwest later this week to promote the president's economic record and take a rare shot at his predecessor's approach. Team Biden has spent the last 2 years playing defense on the economy, with economic numbers and consumer vibes finally improving, including a 28% jump in consumer sentiment since November. Officials are now going on offense. The White House wants to turn November's election, obviously, into a choice between Biden and Trump. Now they're deploying Yellen to Middle America to help set the stage for the economic argument and contrast that Biden will make all year. Yellen reportedly will say, in the Trump administration, the idea of doing anything to fix it was a punchline, but this administration has delivered. The draft speech adds the bipartisan infrastructure law is a $1.2 trillion investment in our nation's future, It is bringing new opportunities within reach for middle-class families. Yellen will make her case to the Chicago Economic Club on Thursday, the same day the Commerce Department will announce GDP for 2023. Yellen, who rarely mentions the Trump administration by name, will draw implicit and explicit comparisons between the economic values of her candidate and the predecessor. She will specifically call out Trump's signature 2017 tax deal, parts of which expire at the end of 2025, and argue that it benefited corporations at the expense of the middle class. It'll be interesting to see how she quantifies that. She'll also note that 2023 didn't experience the recession that many economists had predicted, and that the unemployment rate, headline anyway, has been under 4% for just about 2 years. Biden started 2024 with a speech near Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where he mentioned Trump 44 times in 30 minutes, blaming the former president for spreading lies that led to the January 6th Capitol riot. Across the government, the White House is working to establish Trump as a foil heading into the election. The task, though, is much trickier on the economy, as many Americans tell pollsters that they felt better about their economic prospects under Trump. But top Biden advisors are convinced that voters' opinions on Biden's handling of the economy will start to improve as the rate of inflation slows and real incomes increase, they hope. Eventually, the bad economic vibes will give way to the strong economic data, including consumer sentiment, a record high S&P 500, and lower inflation, they say. That theory was bolstered on Friday, of course, when the Michigan consumer sentiment surged 9 points to its highest level since 2021. Meanwhile, inflation expectations for the year ahead are 2.9%. That's down about 0.2 percentage point from December. So who knows what happens between now and November? As I like to say, we shall certainly see. And last today, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets, featuring Melody's weekly recap of the markets, Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin blog, and Apothecary Herb's Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought column. Plus, I have a piece on Friday's report on the latest leading economic indicators index, the Conference Board's so-called LEI index. Fell by 0.1% last month and was down 2.9% over the second half of 2023. Now, on the one hand, that's lower than the 4.3% for the previous six-month period. On the other, they say the index continues to signal underlying weakness in the U.S. economy. That's according to Justina Zabinski-LaMonica, who's Senior Manager for Business Cycle Indicators at the Conference Board. Despite the overall decline, she adds, six of the LEI's 10 indicators were positive in December. Nonetheless, she pointed out, these improvements were more than offset by weak conditions in manufacturing, the high interest rate environment, and low consumer confidence. She noted that the LEI 6 and 12-month growth rates have turned upward but remain negative, continuing to signal the risk of recession. She said the board expects GDP growth to turn negative during the second and third quarters this year, but begin to recover late in the year. Sounds like a 2020 pandemic-type recession. Good luck. Economists at Too Big to Fail Wells Fargo also said the LEI still signals recession. Yet, they added, a milder pace of contraction and broad-based improvements in the index's components suggest activity, especially in interest rate-sensitive sectors, has found a floor. Now, as Tim Smart writes, the LEI has a history of predicting recessions, but a number of economists claim it hasn't been as dependable since the economy has recovered from the pandemic, particularly because of the several trillions of dollars pumped into the economy by the White House, Congress, and the Fed. and of course, the brutal disruptions to global supply chains over the past couple of years have largely been eliminated, Houthi terror in the Red Sea notwithstanding. Plus, consumer sentiment, retail sales, and jobless claims were mostly positive, particularly later last year, and taken together were consistent with an expanding economy. Whether that continues, obviously, is debatable. Later this week, on Thursday again, the Commerce Department will release its first estimate of fourth quarter and annualized 2023 GDP growth, with forecasts of a number in the 1.7 to 2.0% range. The Atlanta Fed's 2.4% estimate is probably an outlier, sitting at more than half a percentage point higher than the midpoint of the range predicted by the so-called blue chip consensus. Assuming the actual rate will be closer to the consensus, Smart believes that will cap a year that turned out to be more resilient and stronger than the best and brightest predicted just last January. And now those same economists, some of whom, like Paul Krugman, have been on a mea culpa tour of sorts, have bought into the likelihood of a soft landing for the economy. Still, there are those who see the soft landing scenario as Pollyannish thinking. Vanguard economist, for example, Sean Rathatha, writes, the steady decrease in the pace of inflation around the world in recent months is encouraging. However, should the tensions in the Middle East escalate or continue for an extended period, the risk does increase for an upswing in inflation. Fed has its first meeting of the new year. I think is it today and tomorrow? It's either today or tomorrow, or next Tuesday and Wednesday, after keeping interest rates unchanged at its last three meetings. At its last in December, the Fed indicated that members of its policymaking committee favored at least three rate cuts of at least 25 basis points this year. Although many Wall Streeters and Fed fund futures traders believe the Fed will start cutting rates as early as March, Vanguard sees rate cuts coming in the second half of the year. Rathatha said investor expectations for earlier and more cuts in 2024 just don't acknowledge the challenges of bringing inflation down that last mile to many central banks' 2% targets. And the risk of a new advance in goods prices due to protracted geopolitical tensions could give the Fed and other central bankers something else to consider. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a data-driven Fed in 2024. Go figure. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks, as always, to our stellar production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Stay warm. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I work all night. I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Got me a wealthy